It's day two of the nomination and confirmation hearings of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, and the softballs are flying. No hard questions, no difficult inquiries. They're just letting her answer with prepared answers. The losers, the American public. We're entitled to more from our senators, so stay tuned for the Dirt Show. Today, the Senate members of the Judiciary Committee are examining Judge Amy Coney Barrett to determine her qualifications to serve on the United States Supreme Court. It's a disaster. I've watched the first few question periods, and boy, I hope that future lawyers aren't watching and saying, is this what the legal profession is about? The worst sort of questions, framed ineptly, without real follow-up. What we saw today and what I suspect we'll see in the days to come, with I'm sure some exceptions, because there are some really smart members of the Judiciary Committee, but what we saw for the most part are statements written by staff members, not by the senators themselves. Some of them couldn't even pronounce some of the words. We saw questions written by staff members, answers prepared by the murder board of Judge Barrett. She was ready for every single question. She answered them with a smile. She answered them with confidence. And the senators had, even though they knew what her answers were going to be, they had no idea how to ask a follow-up question. They just threw her softball after softball. I'm not talking about the Republicans. They're supposed to serve up softballs. I'm talking about the Democrats who are trying to serve fastballs and sliders and curveballs. They just didn't know how to ask a question, didn't know how to ask a follow-up question. They asked just the questions that were designed to make points for their constituents, and certainly didn't make very effective points for their constituents at all. Judge Barrett, every time she was asked about her views on Roe versus Wade or the right to bear arms, and Senator Feinstein confused the two cases and talked about Roe when she met Heller, we saw answers that were scripted and very well prepared, quoting Justice Ginsburg when she was up for confirmation, saying, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to decide. I'm not going to give you a hint. I'm not going to give you a forecast. I'm not going to give you a prediction. I'm just not going to answer any of those questions. So they just wasted their time, our time, everybody's time in asking questions that they knew they wouldn't get answers to. And then when there were openings, and there were some openings, they just didn't follow up. Because when you have a staff member write a question, you just don't know what the answer is going to be. I'll never forget, I argued a case in the United States Supreme Court. Early in my career, it was a case involving a motion picture called I Am Curious Yellow. It was an anti-war film made in Sweden, which had a little tiny bit of nudity. Today, you could see it on television. It would probably get rated a kind of G or GP parental guidance or something like that. But it was banned in those days. And Chief Justice Berger, who looked like the Chief Justice, he had a mane of white hair and he had this deep stentorian voice, but was not a particularly brilliant jurist, came in with a list of questions for me. And the first question he asked me, I answered differently from what he thought I would answer. And then he asked me a series of questions based on the assumption that I had answered it the way he thought I would answer it. And the questions just made no sense in light of my answer. And finally, Justice Brennan, who was sitting kind of next to him, poked him and said, don't you understand? He said, no. Why are you pursuing it in that way? That's what I saw this morning with the questions asked by the senators. They should have known exactly how she was going to answer every question, and they should have had follow-ups prepared, but they didn't. For example, on Roe versus Wade, they just asked her whether she would overrule Roe versus Wade. They knew that she was going to say, I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to vote, and I'm not supposed to tell you in the Code of Professional Responsibility, the Canon of Ethics, all say I'm not supposed to tell you. She is, after all, a sitting judge today. Even if she weren't confirmed, she might get cases like that presented to her, and judges are not supposed to anticipate in public what their views are going to be on the bench. So instead of asking hard questions about whether she could recuse herself from Roe versus Wade, because she, after all, wrote an article in which she said that when the law, and Roe versus Wade is the law, it's a almost 50-year-old precedent, when the law conflicts with my personal morality or my obligations to my religion, she said, I might have to recuse myself. They didn't pursue the recusal. I'm sure they will today. But it raises the question for me as to whether this process of having senators ask questions of nominees is the right process for confirming a justice. I don't think it's the right process. I think it simply encourages posturing and turning the process into political campaign speeches for one's constituents. Again, Senator Feinstein talked about how when she was the mayor of San Francisco, when she was deeply involved with gay people and talked about a gay couple, it was very sympathetic, it was very emotional, it had nothing to do with whether or not the nominee would support gay rights, gay marriage, decriminalization. Again, she just didn't answer the questions. What I would propose in the future, and I had actually proposed this in the past on the Durst Show, is that the committee, particularly the minority members of the committee members who are opposed to the nomination and want to really try to get information out that might change a vote or two among the senators, that they not conduct the questions themselves, that they bring in a brilliant outside lawyer, somebody who may themselves be opposed to the nomination, somebody who has experience in the Senate as a staff member, but somebody who really knows how to ask questions, and to have that lawyer pose the questions and do the follow-up questions and really get to the bottom of what the justice is thinking, knowing that she's not going to answer specific questions about up-and-coming cases, but still being able to get answers that are a lot more probative of her views than the answers that are gotten today from senators. I don't mean to demean the senators. Senators are good at what they do. They're good at passing legislation. They may be good at having committee hearings on non-legal issues, on political issues, or on policy issues, but they're just, with some exceptions, not very good at the confirmation process. And past experience showed that they turned the confirmation process into something it was never intended to be under the Constitution. The Constitution says the president shall, by and with the consent of the Senate, nominate and appoint justices to the Supreme Court. Advice and consent of the Senate. That's what we're looking for, advice and consent. Presidents sometimes do seek the advice of senators in advance. Often they don't. Often they just surprise the senators and make their own choices. But then the Senate is supposed to consent. And consent requires informed consent. You have to know what you're getting, particularly when you're appointing somebody under the current rules for a lifetime. Judge Barrett is, I think, 47 years old, maybe 48, 47, 48, in that range. If she lives as long as Justice Ginsburg, she could serve on the Supreme Court for 40 years, beyond the life expectancy of any of the current senators who are serving on the Judiciary Committee. So they are making a decision for their children and grandchildren. You know, in 2060, we may have her deciding issues that we have no idea what the issues are going to be in 2060. Go back 40 years now and go back to 1980. Imagine, we didn't know about cyber issues. We didn't know about a range of other issues. We didn't even really know about gay rights back in the day. Nobody had thought that gay rights were constitutional rights. Nobody thought that the Second Amendment protected the individual personal right to own guns. These are issues that changed dramatically in the past 40 years. So we have to project forward what the issues are going to be in the next 40 years. Look, Judge Barrett will almost certainly be confirmed. It would be by a partisan vote, probably be 51 to 49 as a result of two votes. She will serve on the Supreme Court for the rest of her life, and we all hope she lives a long, healthy life. She impresses as a wonderful person, wonderful woman, wonderful mother, wife, citizen, and decent person. But that's not the issue for a lifetime appointment. The issue for a lifetime appointment is, what impact will she have on American law? What impact will she have on constitutional rights? What impact will she have in interpreting a legislation, in interpreting the vague words of the Constitution, words like equal protection, due process, cruel and unusual punishment, words that require interpretation? And it's very hard to say you're a textualist. Sure, it's easy to be a textualist when the provision of the Constitution is no person shall be a president in less than 35 years old. We know what it means to be 35 years old. Just take out the dictionary, take out a calendar, take out a birth certificate. That's an easy case. But when you're talking about the equal protection of the laws, and you're asking about whether equal protection includes giving preferences based on race or gender or sexual orientation, there's no guidance for that. The Equal Protection Clause was written at a time when it never occurred to anybody that affirmative action had any role, positive or negative, in the Constitution. So you're going to have to interpret that phrase. You're going to have to interpret the phrase, the due process of law. What does the due process of law mean textually? All it means is the process that is due to you. Talk about a tautology. What is the process that is due to you? Does it mean that Congress has to have a good reason, a strong reason for impinging on your liberty? Does it mean that states can prohibit gay people from marrying each other if they love each other? Where are you going to find in the text of the Constitution answers to those questions? The answer is you're not, of course. You're going to have to go back and look at the history, and you'll find that the framers, these issues simply never occurred to them. So in the end, you're going to have to put some value judgments into phrases like equal protection, due process, cruel and unusual punishment. Take cruel and unusual punishment. We know that capital punishment was common at the time of the Bill of Rights, and for a lot of good reasons. Number one, we didn't have prisons. We didn't start building prisons in the United States until Jackson's election. Jacksonian democracy included the building of massive prisons all over the United States. And the building of prisons was regarded as a very progressive, liberal idea, because it meant you didn't have to execute people. Before the building of prisons, you really only had limited numbers of options. You could warn them. You could fine them. You could brand them, or you could physically punish them by whipping them, but you couldn't confine them. So if a person was dangerous and couldn't be freed or released, we didn't have the option of imprisonment. Oh, you could put them in jail for a short period of time, but jails were just literally cells in the middle of town. You couldn't send them to a penitentiary, a large institution. The building of the prison meant, yes, you had an option. You had an alternative to physical punishment. You had an alternative to the death penalty. We now live in an age where we have massive imprisonment. Does that mean that the death penalty is cruel and unusual? Well, the Constitution talks about the death penalty. It imposes it. I think it's mentioned 5 times in the Constitution. A pure textualist would say if it's in the Constitution, it's constitutional. Others, the justice for whom I clerked, Justice Goldberg, many, many years ago, said, no, it's an evolving concept. And the death penalty has now been abolished all over the Western world. We are the only Western democracy that still routinely executes people, and therefore it's unconstitutional. The court has actually split the difference and said, no, the death penalty is not unconstitutional for premeditated murder or certain other kinds of murders, but it is unconstitutional for crimes less than murder, for armed robbery, for rape, for extortion, for other crimes that historically carried the death penalty. So we see changes in our approach to constitutional interpretation, and it's very useful to have people who are appropriately educated asking the hard questions. So again, I go back to my point. The Democrats in Congress should not have left it to Senator Feinstein to ask the questions. They learned nothing, they gained nothing from her question period, and I suspect that will be true of some other of the people on both sides of the aisle. They would have been far better off had they gotten a very experienced lawyer to ask very hard questions, follow-up questions. Maybe the original questions could be drafted by the senators or approved by the senators, but then you have to give the lawyer the opportunity to follow up and ask the hard questions. So in the end, I don't think we're going to learn very much. I'm going to watch, of course, because, you know, maybe there'll be an opening. Maybe she'll make a mistake. Maybe she'll open the door to some questions. I would hope she would be asked about her recusal policies, because she wrote about that. And she did say at the hearings that she would be prepared to answer questions about things she's written about law review articles. And that is the law review article that is most relevant to her role on the Supreme Court. She, after all, did say in that law review article that there are going to be situations, particularly in the context of capital punishment. She views the Catholic Church's views on capital punishment as binding on her. Other Catholics do not. Justice Scalia did not. But she does. And she views the Church's views on abortion as binding on her. Justice Scalia agreed with her on that. And so it's a very relevant question. It doesn't go to her faith. It doesn't go to where she prays. It doesn't go to how she brings up her family. It doesn't go to what God she believes in or how she regards faith in her personal life. It goes to an issue that's extremely relevant. That is the issue of how she would decide cases. Would she recuse herself? I give you one hypothetical. What if the Constitution were amended to provide for a woman's right to choose abortion up until the last trimester? Just hypothetically. And she were asked to apply that. Her own view is that it's immoral to abort a child, a fetus. It's immoral and in violation of her church's rules. Would she have to recuse herself? Because she wouldn't have the out of saying, the law agrees with my personal view. She could say that today, perhaps, but she couldn't say that if there were a constitutional amendment. I don't think she could say that in light of Roe versus Wade, a almost 50-year-old precedent, but she might. She might follow Justice Scalia in the Casey decision, in which he said he would overrule Roe versus Wade because it was bad law when it was decided. It's bad law now. And he said, I never took an oath to follow my colleagues in precedent. I took an oath to follow the Constitution. So she might very well find an out there, but she wouldn't find an out if the Constitution were amended. She would answer by saying, I don't respond to hypothetical questions. But there are ways in which lawyers could press her very hard on her views on recusal and her views particularly on recusal in the context of abortion and in the context of capital punishment. Much more relevantly, abortion than capital punishment, because the Supreme Court gets very few capital punishment cases, and views on capital punishment are very case-specific, relate to the particular facts of cases, and she might very well find in the cases that come before her that the justification for the death penalty isn't there, so there's no conflict. But in the abortion context, she's going to get cases. She's going to get another Roe versus Wade. She's going to get a case of a woman, you know, some 18, 19, 20-year-old woman who will come to her and say, I was either raped, or I made a mistake, or I didn't consent, or things have changed. I need to have an abortion. I have a right to have an abortion. Please, court, allow me to have an abortion. I live in a state where it's restricted. She's going to have to rule on that, and her personal views don't allow her to rule in favor of a woman having an abortion, even if the law requires it. And we're entitled to know whether she will sit on such a case, and we're not entitled to know how she will vote necessarily, but we are entitled to know whether she will sit on such a case. She copped out today. She said, look, there are rules regarding recusal. There are rules in the statute books. There are rules and precedents in the Supreme Court. I will follow those rules. Not good enough. You've written about this. You've opened the door, Judge Barrett. You have written a brilliant law review article. In fact, it's really a good law review article that if I had been teaching now, I'd probably assign to my students because it's excellently written and excellently thought out. Nobody could really challenge her thoughtfulness and her credibility. But has she changed her mind since she wrote that opinion? Was the opinion in the law review article hers or that of her senior author? Would she follow what she wrote in that law review article as a judge, or is it just something that she would think about as a law professor or as a young lawyer? These are views that I think we're entitled to know about, and I suspect we're not going to hear very much. So what's going to happen is we're going to have several days of largely mediocre questions and largely canned answers. We will learn very little. There will be a vote of the Senate Judiciary Committee along completely partisan lines. I don't think we're going to see a single Democrat vote for the nomination, a single Republican vote against it. We're going to see party line votes. The one thing that's clear, and I think we learned it even before we saw these hearings, is that by any standards of personal qualifications, Judge Barrett, who would probably not have been my choice, had I been asked by the president to recommend somebody for the Supreme Court. But that's not the issue. The issue is she qualified by traditional standards of intellect? Yes, clearly. Integrity? Yes, clearly. Personal characteristics? Yes, clearly. Nobody can challenge her. This is not going to be a Judge Kavanaugh or a Justice a Thomas type hearing. And it's not going to be Bork, only because Bork, who I knew as a professor at Yale, was a cantankerous guy, very, very tough and wouldn't take anything from anybody and just answered back everything. And as a result of that, I think turned off a number of Democrats who probably would have voted for him. We're not going to see that from Judge Barrett. We're going to see very kind-hearted, very appreciative answers. We're not going to see her lose her temper. So in terms of personal qualities, she's going to get confirmed. The only two issues, and there are really only two issues, is whether yet another Republican, two have already abandoned the Republicans, whether yet another Republican or two will say, you know, it's too late in the process. We're now, today, 3 weeks before Election Day. Should a president who may well lose the election really have the power to appoint somebody to serve for 40 years on the court? Should the dead hand of a former president continue to have that kind of influence for 40 years, particularly on a 51-49 vote along party lines? That's a question that some senators will ask. The question is, are there going to be one or two Republicans who will be influenced by their answer to that question? So that's number one question. The number two question is, does her previously expressed views on policies such as the Affordable Care Act, gay rights, abortion rights, gun control, a range of other issues, are they sufficiently concerning to one or two Republican senators who are up for re-election to make them worry that a vote for her confirmation might lose them votes in their current election? Remember, November 3rd is not only election day for the president, it's the election day for one-third of the Senate. And there are a number of Republicans who are in tough, tough races, including the chairman of the committee. He doesn't seem to be much influenced by that in his questioning of Judge Barrett. But there are some others who might be, maybe not members of the Judiciary Committee, but members of the Senate. And remember, they need 51 votes to win, or at least 50, subject to the president of the Senate, namely the Vice President of the United States, casting the deciding vote. So a missed opportunity to educate the American public about the confirmation process, a missed opportunity to learn as much as we can within the constraints of the confirmation process about the views of Judge Barrett, a missed opportunity to see really, really good lawyers at work in trying to elicit information from people who don't want to elicit information. Let's remember what the job of a lawyer is. The job of a lawyer is not to ask questions where the answers are simple or obvious. The job of a good lawyer on cross-examination is to make the witness say things they don't want to say, to give them no choice, to give them no option at all. It's said that great cross-examiners, like great gamblers, if you're running a gambling casino and you're betting on sports, you don't even watch the game necessarily, because you've won before a single ball is thrown or a single blow is landed in a boxing match, because you've laid off all the bets, and no matter who wins, you win. That's the way good betting operations, good betting casinos work. The same thing is true of great questions on cross-examination. You ask a question that there's no possible good answer to. If they answer yes, you can prove they're committing perjury. If you answer no, they've admitted that they've done something, or the reverse. But the asking of the question is decisive. The answer isn't as important, because either answer will open up the witness to collateral consequences. We didn't see any of that, and I don't think we're going to see any of that. So to my law students and to young lawyers and to people trying to learn how to be great lawyers, do not learn from most of the senators at the confirmation hearing. You can do better than that. There will be some good questions by some senators, but be very selective in what you watch and what you learn. The losers, the American people. The American people rely on their elected representatives, on their senators, to ask the hard questions. They're not getting their money's worth. So maybe you can ask some hard questions. Send me some questions that you would ask Judge Barrett, and I will get them to the right people. I have former students who are staff members. I have former students who are senators, who are members of the Judiciary Committee. So if you get me some good, hard questions, particularly those that there's no good answer to, I promise you I'll get them to the right people. I can't promise you they'll ask those questions, but I can promise you you'll at least get an opportunity to have me send the questions to the right people. Keep the questions short. Questions have to be like 30 seconds long. Questions are not filibusters. Still a role for filibusters, not in the nominating process to the Supreme Court. They've abolished the filibuster there. But we don't want filibuster questions. We just want questions that are 30 seconds in length. I'll answer them, and then I'll send them on to the right people. Make sure your questions are sharp and apt and relevant, and they'll get to the right source. So again, what you're going to hear from me on the Durr Show always is objective, unbiased, neutral, non-political analysis of what you're seeing in the news. So keep watching the Durr Show and keep sending me good questions. Now it's your turn to ask me questions. Please keep them short and to the point. Libby from Florida.
My question I have is, what is the law regarding privately owned drones that are surveilling private homeowners? And I looked on the internet, and all I see is that about airspace. Is there, and what kind of attorney would be used to litigate something that where you're being harassed by private drones? Thank you. Would love to hear from you. Bye.
What a great question. It's a perfect illustration of what I've been saying. 40 years ago, when justices were confirmed to the Supreme Court, nobody heard of drones. The framers never heard of drones. There can't be anything in the Constitution about drones, nothing in the Constitution even about airplanes. There are some cases in point. There are cases in which law enforcement has flown planes over people's homes in order to see whether they're growing marijuana. And the Supreme Court has generally approved that by law enforcement. But today there is no really governing law on private drones that are harassing private landowners. It would vary state to state. Obviously, there'd be room for federal regulation because drones can fly in its state commerce. After all, what is a drone? You can have a drone that can fly across the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean. It's just a non-piloted airplane. Drones are today fighting wars. So we need legislation to protect the privacy of people from drones. Obviously, people have swimming pools and hot tubs, and if anybody wants to skinny dip in their own property, they have a right to, and should drones have a right to photograph you in the privacy of your own home? Of course not. There are privacy lawyers. Right now, I think the case would be a difficult one to bring absent legislation, but if you brought such a case, it might stimulate legislation, and maybe some state courts would say there's a basic common law right of privacy that's violated by drones deliberately flying over your home. Welcome to the 21st century, and drones are part of the 21st century, and the law has to adapt to changing technology. Our next question comes from Boston.
Hello, Professor. My question relates to our nation's universities increasingly muzzling unpopular speech. You taught at Harvard for 50 years. Looking back, when do you think the intolerance began to accelerate? And what do you think lies beneath it? I really enjoy your show.
Thanks, Preston. I'm tempted to say the intolerance at Harvard began the day I left, because 6 years ago or whatever I left Harvard, I would fight against the intolerance all the time. Let me give you an example. So Yasser Arafat died. And I hated Yasser Arafat. I believed he was a mass murderer who had killed many Americans, many Israelis, many Jews. He was a mass murderer, blood on his hands. Palestinian students wanted to fly a flag in memory of Yasser Arafat. And the school said, no, you can't fly the Palestinian flag because we have a rule that in Harvard Yard, you can only fly the flags of countries that are members of the United Nations. A foolish rule. So the Palestinian students came to me, a Jewish Zionist, First Amendment advocate, to ask whether I would defend them. And I said, yes, here's the deal. What am I quoting Joe Biden now? Here's the deal, I said to them. I will defend your right to fly the flag. We will win because you have the rights on your side. But when you fly the Palestinian flag in memory of Yasser Arafat, I'm going to hand out leaflets telling the truth about Arafat, of what a terrible, horrible man he was. So you'll fly your flag, I'll hand out my leaflets, and I'll take your case with the understanding that I'm going to do that. And they said, fine. And we won. And sure enough, the flag went up, my leaflets went out. The First Amendment was alive and well at Harvard. That's no longer the case. You get Professor Ron Sullivan, who's a great lawyer and a great professor and was the dean of one of the residential colleges at Harvard. He briefly represented Harvey Weinstein, who was charged with serious criminal conduct. As a result of that, the snowflake students in his house said, we're afraid of Judge Sullivan and his wife, of Ron Sullivan and his wife. We're afraid of him. He's put fear in our heart because he's representing somebody we don't like. And sure enough, Ron Sullivan got fired. Is that tolerance? Is that free speech? No. What we're seeing on universities is the end of free speech and the introduction of political correctness. The University of Chicago Department of English Literature has now said, we're only going to accept students who are going to focus on issues regarding Black Lives Matter. And we now stand for a policy of so-and-so on racial issues. What if you're a dissenter? What if you don't agree with Black Lives Matter? What if you think it's a platform includes some elements of bigotry? Are you not welcome in that department anymore? Look, university departments shouldn't take positions on political issues. And so I think we're really facing a struggle about the role of universities. In my view, universities should not teach you what to think. They should teach you how to think. And they should teach critical thinking. And they should encourage debate and discourse. The president of the University of Chicago issued an interesting statement about the English department and reaffirmed the right of dissent. Universities are places where people have the right to take positions on politics, but the university itself shouldn't take positions on politics. Our final call today is from Tyler in New York.
Hello, Tyler from Suffolk County, New York. I hope you're doing well, Professor Dershowitz. And I wanted to know if, since the Supreme Court can be expanded with a simple bill, can it also be made to remain at 9 justices, also with a simple bill? Thank you.
That's a great question. Legislation can determine the size of the Supreme Court within limits. You don't need a law to keep it at 9. The law today is that it is 9. You'd need a law to expand it to 11 or 13. You could also contract it and bring it down to 7 or 9, but you couldn't eliminate any of the sitting justices. You can say the Supreme Court's going to be 7, and the next 2 vacancies that occur will not be filled. That would be constitutional and lawful. Look, we've settled on 9. There's no magic number in 9, but we've had 9 for now. It's almost 150 years. Let's keep it at 9. It means liberals will win some and lose some. Conservatives will win some and lose some. It will change over the years. We'll have decades where you'll have a conservatively dominated court. You'll have decades with a liberally dominated court. That's the nature of a judicial institution. But the idea of changing the number for political partisan purposes simply to add justices that support one particular point of view was not a good idea when Franklin Delano Roosevelt proposed it, and it's not a good idea today when some of the radicals in the Democratic Party propose it. So, told you you'd never be bored. We live in fascinating times. I guess it's a Chinese curse. At least I'm told. I don't know whether it's true or not. A Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. Let me add to that. May you listen to interesting podcasts. And I think you'll agree with me that when you listen to The Dirt Show, you'll never be bored. Remember, we'll take your calls 24/7, anytime, day or night. Make your call, and I will respond on The Dirt Show.